Usually when we talk about human perception, there's this underlying expectation of passive precision.
Right.
We tend to think of our eyes and ears like, well, like a highly advanced video camera.
Like a GoPro strapped to your forehead.
Yeah, exactly. You just open your eyes, the light hits your retina, and the brain just presses record and says, there it is. That's objective reality.
It's a very comforting assumption, honestly. I mean, we walk through the world feeling as though our environment is just simply revealing itself to our senses in real time, completely unfiltered.
Yeah, it feels like a direct feed. But then you step into the bleeding edge of modern neurocognitive science, and suddenly that whole video camera metaphor is completely shattered.
Oh, completely.
We're looking at a landscape of human consciousness that is honestly much more like an active, relentless, and occasionally terrifying construction zone. We are constantly building the world we think we're just passively observing.
It is the absolute definition of a dynamic interpretive hallucination that we just happen to agree on.
Okay, let's unpack this because today we are going to explore a paradigm-shifting concept about how your mind actually constructs the reality you experience millisecond by millisecond.
Yeah, it's incredibly fast.
Right. We are doing a deep dive exclusively focused on the independent researcher Jason Brissart's perceptual framing theory, or PFT for short.
Right, PFT.
And our mission today is to understand not just what this bleeding-edge neurocognitive model claims, but exactly how modern science could possibly test something so incredibly abstract in a physical laboratory.
Which is the hardest part.
Totally.
Yeah.
And naturally, why it is causing so much intense friction with established academic methods.
Yeah, the friction is, it's palpable. PFT challenges the foundational assumptions of how a lot of neuroscience labs currently operate.
Right.
To understand why, we really have to establish the core premise of Brissart's model, which is that consciousness is not a passive window. It is an active, recursive construction process shaped by transient, temporary scaffolds. And he calls these scaffolds frames.
Okay, so frames, which means they are constantly being built, utilized, and then torn down in real time.
Exactly.
So we don't actually experience reality. We experience what it's framed.
Yes.
The brain is taking in all this raw data, but the data means absolutely nothing until it's placed within an interpretive frame.
Yeah.
And that specific frame dictates what you consciously feel, see, and believe in any given fraction of a second.
What's really fascinating here is the structural anatomy of that frame, because before we can even discuss putting someone in an fMRI scanner to test
Right,
this,
the lab stuff.
yeah, we have to define what we're actually looking for. So Brissart defines an interpretive frame mathematically.
Which is wild.
It is. He defines it as a four-component tuple. The equation is F equals PMAI.
It is wild to see mathematical structure applied directly to, like, the subjective feeling of human consciousness.
It really is.
Let's break down the anatomy of that equation, starting with the P. What is the P?
So P stands for perceptual anchors. This is the raw sensory data extracted from your environment. The light hitting your eyes, the sound waves vibrating your eardrums, the tactile pressure of the chair you're sitting in right now.
Right, all the physical inputs.
Exactly. All of this data flows into the posterior sensory cortices of the brain. But, and this is a really vital distinction, the P isn't all the data available in your environment.
Oh, it's not.
No, it is only the salient features, the anchors.
Gotcha.
It's the specific isolated details your brain decides to grab onto in that exact millisecond.
Which implies that the brain is already heavily filtering reality before we even get to the interpretation phase.
Heavily filtering, yes.
Like, if you are walking down a chaotic, crowded city street, your perceptual anchors aren't every single pedestrian, every billboard, and every taxi.
No, that would overwhelm the system.
Right. The P might just be the sudden wail of a police siren, or maybe the flash of a bright red jacket moving quickly in your peripheral vision.
Precisely. The brain selects an anchor. And the moment it does, that sensory anchor is immediately combined with the second variable in the equation, which is the M contextual memory.
And that's handled primarily by the hippocampus,
The
right?
hippocampus and the surrounding parahippocampal circuits, yes.
Oof.
So as soon
Okay.
as that perceptual anchor registers,
A siren, in our example.
right, the siren, your brain dives into its massive internal archives. It pulls up episodic memories, which are specific events that have happened to you,
Okay.
as well as semantic memories, which are just basic facts you know about the world. It looks for absolutely anything that matches the current sensory input.
Right. So if you hear that siren, your hippocampus instantly pulls up your previous experiences with sirens, emergencies, traffic accidents, or or even like a movie you watched last night.
Exactly. It's providing the necessary backstory for the raw data.
Wow.
Because a siren is just a sound wave until the hippocampus says, hey, last time we heard this, there was a fire.
That makes so much sense.
But, you know, a backstory alone is dry. It needs a tone. Which brings us to the third component, the A, affective tone.
Affective tone. Okay.
This is the emotional valence and the intensity of the moment, and it's driven fundamentally by the amygdala and the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, or VMPFC.
The emotional centers.
Right. The affective tone determines how you feel about the backstory. Is this siren a threat? Does it make your heart race with panic because you think something is wrong? Or, conversely, do you feel a sudden wave of relief because, say, you've been waiting for an ambulance to arrive?
Oh, wow. So the affective tone is essentially the emotional coloring of the entire experience.
Yes.
It dictates the literal physical feeling in your gut.
Yes. And that emotional coloring leads directly into the final unifying pillar of the equation, the I, the interpretive structure.
The I.
This is managed by the medial prefrontal cortex, the MPFC. Think of the MPFC as the director of a film.
Yeah, I like that analogy.
It takes the sensory data from the P, the backstory from the M, the emotional stakes from the A, and it writes the overarching narrative, the categorical lens. The director says, there is a dangerous emergency happening down the street, and I need to cross to the other side to stay safe.
Okay, so the frame, the F in our equation, is the absolute simultaneous merger of P, M, A, and I.
Yes.
The sensory anchor, the memory, the emotion, and the story.
All at once.
And the critical insight of perceptual framing theory
seems
to be that these four pillars merge to create a single conscious moment.
Mm-hmm.
We don't experience them sequentially.
That's the key. If we connect this to the bigger picture of how we actually live our lives, like simultaneity is everything.
Right.
You don't think to yourself, I hear a loud noise. Let me check my memory banks. Okay, now let me generate a feeling of fear. All right, now let me write a story about running away.
That would be so slow.
It would be incredibly inefficient and biologically dangerous. It all collapses into one unified feeling of now. And if any one of those four variables shifts, the entire conscious experience of that moment changes entirely.
Okay, let me try an analogy here. Think of it like applying a highly advanced augmented reality filter to your smartphone camera.
Oh, okay.
You point your phone at your living room. The filter doesn't just change the color grading or the lighting, mm-hmm. which in this case would be the affective tone, the A.
Right.
It simultaneously pulls up old photos from your camera roll and projects them onto the walls. That's your contextual memory, the M.
I love this.
And it selectively highlights specific objects, like making your keys glow while blurring out the background. That's the perceptual anchors, the P.
Exactly.
And then at the bottom of your screen, it auto-generates a caption explaining exactly what is happening in the room, the interpretive structure, the I.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. And the illusion is that when you look at the screen, you assume you are just seeing your living room, but you aren't. You are seeing the living room strictly through the filter. You are seeing the frame.
Let's make this incredibly concrete for you, the listener. Think about a moment when your mood completely changed how you interpreted a simple text message.
Oh, this happens all the time.
All the time. You get a text from a friend, and all it says is, we need to talk.
A classic ambiguous input. It's the perfect blank canvas for a frame.
Exactly. So if you are in a fantastic mood, maybe you just got a promotion at work, the sun is shining, you feel great, your affective tone, your A, is highly positive.
Right.
Because of that, your contextual memory, your M, is biased. Mm. The hippocampus pulls up recent times you and this friend celebrated together.
Mm-hmm.
And then your interpretive structure, the I, writes a wonderful narrative. You think, oh, they probably want to plan a dinner to celebrate my promotion. This is great news.
But let's change one variable. Let's keep the exact same sensory input, but alter the affective tone.
Right. Let's say you are feeling incredibly anxious, insecure, and exhausted that day.
Yeah.
The exact same text message arrives on your screen.
Mm.
The perceptual anchor, the P, is mathematically identical. We need to talk.
But your A variable is bathed in anxiety.
Yeah, your amygdala is firing.
Exactly.
Because the A is negative, your hippocampus retrieves a totally different set of memories. It pulls up times you fought with this friend or times someone abruptly canceled plans or criticized you.
Yeah.
And your MPFC, the I, writes a terrifying new narrative. They are furious with me. I did something wrong. Our friendship is over.
And this raises a really important question, right? Is that just a mood swing?
Yeah.
According to PFT, absolutely not. That is a literal neurobiological shift in the architecture of your reality.
Yeah.
The A component forcefully rewrote the I component. In that moment of panic, you are not actually experiencing the text message. You are experiencing the anxious frame that your brain constructed around the text message.
Which is profound when you really sit with it. You are literally trapped inside the math of your own brain. Every assumption you make is just the output of an equation.
Exactly.
Which naturally leads us to the mechanics. Because
yeah.
Now that we know the ingredients of a frame, the P, M, A, and I, how does the biological meat of the brain actually assemble them?
Right, the assembly line.
Yeah, and how fast is this happening? We need to move from the abstract structure of the frame to the greedy mechanics of the assembly line.
Well, Brizard outlines a five-phase recursive cycle that unfolds across various brain networks over milliseconds.
Milliseconds.
Yeah. Occasionally, a frame persists for minutes if you are deep in concentrated thought, but the initial construction is lightning fast, operating entirely beneath your conscious awareness.
So this is a sub-second assembly line. How does the cycle actually begin?
It begins with what he calls priming and candidate activation.
Okay.
Your brain is a relentless prediction machine. It's constantly scanning both incoming environmental data and your internal bodily states like your heart rate or your hormone levels. Before you ever consciously register what is happening around you, your hippocampus and amygdala are rapidly retrieving a whole pool of potential frames.
Like a neural casting call.
That's a great way to put it. It's essentially a neural casting call. The brain looks at the raw data and asks, based on this input, what are all the possible interpretations of reality right now?
So it's lining up a dozen different lenses it could potentially look through. It drafts the celebration narrative and the our friendship is over narrative at the exact same time.
Yes, but human consciousness is singular. You cannot be consciously aware of a dozen conflicting realities simultaneously.
Right, that would be chaos.
Total chaos. So the brain has to make a choice, which brings us to the second phase, salience arbitration.
Arbitration. Sounds formal.
It sounds formal, but this is not a gentle compromise. It is a brutal neural battleground.
Oh, wow.
The anterior cingulate cortex, the ACC, acts as the brain's conflict monitor. It detects that there are competing frames trying to gain access to consciousness. Meanwhile, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the DLPFC, and the MPFC act as the judges. They rapidly evaluate all these candidate frames based on how well they fit the sensory data and, crucially, how strongly they resonate with your current emotional state.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Brizard doesn't just describe this battleground metaphorically, right?
Yeah.
He formalizes it with an actual equation.
He does.
It's F of T plus 1 equals the select argmax of F, and then in brackets, the weight of P times P plus the weight of M times M, plus the weight of A times A, plus the weight of I times I.
Yes. And I know throwing algebra into a discussion on neuroscience can sound intimidating to some people, but it is beautifully logical once you break it down.
Let's do exactly that. Break down that argmax part for us, because
yeah.
I know throwing algebra in here is intense, but what does finding the argument of the maximum actually mean in the wet biology of your brain?
So in mathematics, argmax is an operation that finds the specific input that gives the maximum value from a target function. In the biology of your brain, it means your prefrontal cortex is calculating the weights, that's the W, in the equation next to each variable. The brain assigns a dynamic multiplier to your perception, your memory, your emotion, and your interpretation.
So the weights aren't fixed. They shift depending on the context.
Exactly. They are highly dynamic. Let's use an extreme example, like a severe phobia or a panic attack.
Okay, sure.
If you are utterly terrified, the weight of your emotion, the W sub A, is massive. It is mathematically overpowering everything else in the equation.
Oh, I see.
You could have overwhelming perceptual anchors showing you that you are perfectly safe, but because the A multiplier is so high, it distorts the math. The brain calculates which candidate frame has the highest total score, the maximum value.
Right.
And because fear is weighted so heavily, the terrifying interpretation wins the argmax competition. That winning frame crosses the threshold into your conscious awareness, and suddenly you are experiencing terror regardless of the objective reality of the room.
Which implies that all those other interpretations,
yeah.
The rational ones that didn't get picked,
yeah.
They don't just disappear, right? What happens to the losing candidate frames?
This is one of the most compelling insights of PFT. Suppressed candidate frames are not erased. They don't vanish into the ether. They lurk in the background of your neural networks as interpretive potentials.
They are waiting in the wings.
Exactly.
They are just sitting there waiting for a moment of cognitive fatigue or a sudden new sensory cue to stage a coup and take over your conscious awareness.
Yeah, staging a coup is a great metaphor.
Think about walking alone at night. Your dominant frame, the one that won the Argmax equation, might be, you know, I am safe, I'm just taking a brisk walk, everything is fine.
Right.
But the suppressed frame of I am being followed and I am in danger is lurking right beneath the surface. All it takes is one snapping twig, a brand new perceptual anchor, and the lurking frame suddenly has enough weight to stage a coup. It takes over the equation, and in a fraction of a millisecond, your reality shifts from a peaceful stroll to pure adrenaline and terror.
Precisely. And once a frame wins that coup, or wins the initial arbitration, it has to be locked into place so you can actually function.
Right, you can't just be flickering between realities.
No, you'd be paralyzed. So that brings us to the third phase, stabilization.
Stabilization.
Once a frame wins the Argmax competition, the default mode network, the DMN, and various frontoparietal networks engage. They sustain your attention, suppress distracting information, and stabilize the narrative.
Okay.
This creates what Brizard calls the felt now. It is the subjective feeling of smooth, continuous reality. You don't feel the messy, brutal assembly line or the mathematical waiting.
You just feel the finished, polished product of the present moment.
Exactly.
But the felt now doesn't last forever. The universe is chaotic. Things change.
Which necessitates the fourth phase, disruption.
Disruption.
Let's go back to your example of walking at night. You are in that panicked frame, convinced you are being followed because of the snapping twig. The frame is stabilized.
Right.
But then a familiar friend steps out from the shadows under a streetlight and says your name.
Oh.
That is a massive prediction violation. The sensory input coming through your eyes and ears completely contradicts the fearful interpretive structure your brain has stabilized.
It totally breaks the narrative.
Your brain registers a profound conflict. Physically, this is marked by gamma band synchronization across cortical areas and sharp spikes in ACC activity. The current frame cannot sustain the contradiction. It destabilizes. It collapses.
Wow. And finally, the dust settles in the fifth phase.
Yes. Loop closure. The frame that ultimately resolves the situation, the, oh, it's just my friend, I'm completely safe frame, doesn't just fade away once the interaction is over.
It gets saved.
Yes. It updates your memory networks. The hippocampus reconsolidates this entire experience so that the next time you walk down that specific street, your baseline priors are updated.
You are less likely to panic at a snapping twig in that exact location.
Exactly. The loop closes, the mathematical weights are subtly adjusted, and the system is ready to begin the priming phase all over again in the very next millisecond.
This is a stunningly elegant way to describe the mechanics of the mind. I mean, the idea of an Argmax equation constantly running in the background of our consciousness makes so much intuitive sense.
It really does.
But, and this is a massive but, it's one thing to write an elegant equation for consciousness on a chalkboard.
Right.
It is entirely another thing to prove it in a physical laboratory with wet biology.
Yeah.
Like, how on earth do we measure a mathematical frame using modern academic methods?
That is the ultimate test of any scientific theory. If it isn't falsifiable, if it doesn't make distinct, measurable predictions that a laboratory can test with standard equipment,
yes,
then it's just philosophy.
It's an interesting thought experiment, but it isn't science.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Brizard has laid out highly specific, falsifiable predictions for clinical and experimental testing. He is actively challenging cognitive neuroscience to look at their fMRI and EEG data through this specific top-down lens.
Okay, let's talk about those specific lab tests. How do we test for the boundaries of these frames?
Brizard proposes several experimental designs, but let's focus on three core areas. The first is testing cognitive rigidity.
Cognitive rigidity.
Imagine a standard laboratory setting using a visual search task.
Right.
A human subject is placed in front of a computer screen filled with various complex images and asked to find a specific target.
A pretty standard setup.
Very standard. But before the task begins, the researchers deliberately prime the subject with a fear-inducing narrative. They show them disturbing imagery or give them really stressful instructions.
So they are artificially spiking that variable, the affective tone.
Right. They are making the subject highly anxious to heavily weight the W sub A in the equation. Now, standard theories of attention would suggest that the subject will just be generally more alert, perhaps a bit jumpy, but their visual field should function normally.
Right. They should still be able to see everything on the screen.
But PFT predicts something much more radical. PFT predicts the lab will see profound attentional tunneling toward threat cues, effectively rendering the subject temporarily blind to neutral stimuli on the screen.
Literally blind.
Behaviorally blind, yes. And more importantly, PFT predicts this behavioral blindness will map directly to hyperstable coupling between the default mode network and the amygdala when observed in an fMRI scanner.
Wow.
The frame becomes mathematically rigid. The subject literally cannot process visual data that falls outside the fearful frame.
Okay, so you can measure the rigidity of the frame using visual tasks and fMRI coupling. What about the memory component, the M? How do you test if the frame is actively rewriting memory?
That's the second proposed test, memory reconstruction.
Memory reconstruction.
This involves an ambiguous video clip experiment. You take two separate groups of participants. You show both groups the exact same, slightly ambiguous video of an interaction between two people. Maybe they're gesturing wildly, speaking in hushed tones.
Okay.
Group A is primed with a aggressive narrative before they watch it. They are told these two people are bitter rivals engaged in a corporate dispute.
Got it.
Group B is primed with a scared narrative. They are told these people are lost in a dangerous neighborhood and are trying to figure out a safe route.
So the perceptual anchors, the pencils of the video on the screen, are 100% identical for both groups.
Exactly identical.
But the interpretive structure, the eye, is being actively manipulated by the researcher's priming.
Exactly. Now, PFT predicts that this priming won't just change their subjective opinions of the video. It will systematically alter the actual factual details they recall later.
They'll remember it differently.
Yes. Group A will confidently remember aggressive physical gestures or angry facial expressions that literally never happened on screen. Group B will confidently remember fearful expressions and cowering posture. Mm. And crucially, Brizard predicts this false memory generation will correlate with distinct, measurable shifts in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Specifically, they will look at bold signals, blood oxygen level dependent imaging recorded during an fMRI.
For those who might not know, Bold signals essentially track blood flow in the brain, right? Active neurons need oxygen, so blood flows to the regions working the hardest.
Yes, Bold imaging is the standard way fMRI measures brain activity. Brizard posits that the fMRI will show the VMPFC aggressively directing the hippocampus to rewrite the memory to fit the stabilized frame.
That is slightly terrifying, honestly. The brain prioritizing a cohesive narrative over factual reality.
It alters the facts to protect the integrity of the math.
Crazy. And the third test gets into some heavy clinical applications, moving beyond just visual tasks and memory into actual trauma and virtual reality.
Yes, testing trauma via VR. PFT posits that psychological trauma is essentially a frame that outright refuses to destabilize.
It gets stuck.
Exactly. The emotional weight of the trauma is so overwhelmingly high that the argmax equation gets permanently stuck. So, researchers place patients diagnosed with PTSD into highly controlled virtual reality simulations. They expose them to slightly ambiguous stimuli, like avatars with neutral or ambiguous facial expressions.
And what are they looking for?
PFT predicts that in these patients, the lab will measure a physical inability to disengage the amygdala, the brain's fear center, even after explicit, undeniable safety cues are introduced into the VR environment.
Like what?
Like the avatar could smile, the environment could turn bright and cheerful, but the patient's brain won't register it. The normal neurobiological phase of disruption phase 4, where the frame collapses due to prediction errors, fails to trigger.
Because the math is stuck.
The frame is fixated. The equation cannot be solved for anything other than threat.
Okay, I have to jump in here and push back on this because as compelling as this sounds, I can hear the cognitive neuroscientist screaming through the speakers right now.
Please, push back. The academic friction is the most important part of this discussion.
Well, if a lab is just looking at an fMRI showing amygdala activation or, you know, tracking a subject's eye movements in a VR headset or looking at Bold signals in the prefrontal cortex, aren't they just measuring standard attention and memory?
Mm-hmm.
We already know the amygdala lights up when people are scared. That's neuroscience 101. We already know memory is fallible and subject to priming.
Right.
We have theories like predictive coding that already say the brain is just guessing what's out there and minimizing errors. How does Brizard's framework isolate the frame itself rather than just measuring the sum of these basic isolated parts and slapping a fancy new PFT label on them.
That is the exact critique that mainstream academia levels at PFT, and it is an incredibly valid challenge.
Right, because you have to prove it's something new.
Exactly. If you are just pointing to a lit up amygdala and saying, look, a frame, you aren't doing rigorous science. Brissart's defense against this critique is what makes the theory so radical. He argues that we have to fundamentally stop looking at static brain regions.
Static regions.
Yeah, like treating the brain as a map where this town does fear and this town does memory. Instead, we have to start looking at the dynamic boundaries of the network. We have to look at the exact timing of synchronization.
Timing over geography.
Exactly. To prove PFT, you don't look at where the brain is lighting up. You look at how different frequencies of electrical activity couple together across massive distances in the brain. The framework requires looking for what's called cross-frequency coupling.
Okay, let's break that down, because cross-frequency coupling sounds like intense jargon. What does that actually look like physically?
Imagine two different metronomes or pendulums swinging at totally different speeds.
Mm-hmm.
One is swinging very slowly. Let's say that's a theta wave rhythm oscillating deep in the hippocampus, pulling up memories.
Slow pendulum. Okay.
The other is swinging incredibly fast. That's a gamma wave rhythm in the prefrontal cortex, handling complex cognitive interpretation. Usually, they are doing their own thing.
Just swinging randomly.
But cross-frequency coupling is the moment those two different rhythms lock in and synchronize perfectly. The fast wave rides precisely on the peak of the slow wave.
Oh, they align. The memory and the interpretation become physically linked by their electrical rhythm.
Yes. Brissart argues we need to look for those specific millisecond scale synchronization events combined with those ACC conflict signals we discussed earlier. That specific electrical signature marks the exact millisecond a frame collapses and a new one takes over.
Man.
He's saying the frame isn't a place in the brain. It's a specific measurable rhythm of network integration. We aren't looking for a noun like a region of gray matter. We are looking for a verb, the act of framing.
So what does this all mean for the scientific community? Because your defense there, demanding that we look for verbs instead of nouns, demanding that we measure millisecond network syncs, that leads perfectly into the intense controversies surrounding PFT.
It's a huge shift.
Why is this framework considered so nuanced, so original, and yet so highly conflicting with established academic methodology?
We have to delve into the limitations and future work section of Brissart's source material to answer that. Because to his credit, he is very transparent about the friction.
Good.
First and foremost is operational ambiguity. Right now, there is no standardized, agreed-upon method in mainstream neuroscience to identify a frame in real time.
Which is a problem if you want to prove it exists.
Exactly. To prove PFT definitively, neuroscience has to invent or massively refine advanced neural decoding tools that can track these multi-regional network integrations on that millisecond scale.
And we don't have those yet.
Not at the level he needs. The current fMRI machines, which measure blood flow over seconds, are simply too slow to catch a frame collapsing in a millisecond.
So he's essentially telling multi-million dollar laboratories, my theory of the mind is correct, your tools just aren't good enough yet to see it.
Yes.
I could see why that would cause a tremendous amount of academic friction. It's a very bold claim.
It is deeply provocative, and that leads to the second major point of friction, the math deficit.
The math deficit.
While Brissart provides that elegant symbolic logic, the argmax equation PFT currently lacks a full computational simulation.
Oh, I see.
In modern cognitive science, especially computational neuroscience, the gold standard is building a working computer model. They demand that you write code that can simulate these dynamics in an artificial neural network before they fully embrace a theory.
They want to see the math run in a simulation.
Exactly. PFT simply isn't there yet. It's theoretical math, not simulated math.
And what about the theories that are already well established and heavily funded? I brought up predictive coding earlier, which is a massive paradigm right now.
This is where the profound ontological conflict happens. Theoretical overlap and conflict. PFT openly borrows heavily from two major existing theories, predictive coding and global neuronal workspace theory.
Okay, so he's building on them.
He is, but predictive coding, as you mentioned, argues that the brain is essentially a prediction engine trying to minimize the error between what it expects and what it senses. Global neuronal workspace theory argues that consciousness is simply whatever piece of information is currently being broadcast globally across the brain's frontoparietal networks.
But Brissart disagrees with their conclusions.
He sharply conflicts with their underlying philosophies of what consciousness actually is. PFT insists that the frame, this specific, irreducible four-part structure of perception, memory, affect, and interpretation, is the foundational unit of experience. It is the atom of consciousness.
Yeah.
He argues that raw predictions are meaningless without an interpretive structure, and a global broadcast is just the result of a frame winning the ArcMax competition, not consciousness itself. He is essentially trying to usurp the two reigning champions of neurocognitive theory.
And then, of course, there is the elephant in the room for literally any theory of consciousness ever proposed, the qualia problem.
Yes, the hard problem. This raises an important question that philosophers of mind will immediately and rightly point out.
Hey.
PFT does a brilliant, intricate job of explaining the structure and the mechanics of the frame. It explains how sensory data is routed, how memory is accessed, how emotions are mathematically weighted, and how networks synchronize. But modern philosophy will push back hard because PFT still fundamentally underspecifies how the actual feeling of consciousness emerges from this map.
The subjective experience. Why does the color red look red to me? Why does the physical feeling of fear in my chest feel like fear? The math explains the routing of the electrical signal through the amygdala and the VMPFC, but it doesn't fully explain how that electrical signal magically turns into the subjective felt presence of human experience.
Exactly. It explains the scaffolding, but not the ghost in the machine. So the friction we see here is essentially a massive clash of paradigms. Modern academia heavily prefers a bottom-up modular explanation of the brain.
Like studying the parts.
They want to say, this region does vision, this region does fear, this region does memory. Let's study them individually in highly controlled isolation. But PFT forces a top-down holistic approach.
You can't isolate them.
No, because Brizard is insisting that the brain operates via these overarching interpretive architectures. You cannot study the components in isolation because the active frame radically changes how the components operate.
He is demanding a paradigm shift in how labs not only design their experiments, but how they interpret their data. He's asking them to measure the invisible scaffolds of meaning-making rather than just cataloging the individual bricks.
It is a tall order for an industry built on reductionism.
We've looked at the math. We've looked at the subsecond assembly line, the VR headsets, the cross-frequency coupling, and the immense academic friction. But I want to bring this whole discussion back down to earth.
Let's do it.
Because we are not all neuroscientists, and we don't live our lives in an fMRI scanner. Why should you, the listener, sitting at home or driving your car or making dinner right now, why should you care about perceptual framing theory? Why does this highly technical model matter to your actual everyday life?
Because whether you realize it or not, we are all constantly framing, and we are all constantly being framed every single moment of your waking life. Every interaction you have, every decision you make is dictated by the output of this ArgMax equation. And understanding that mechanism gives you access to the most powerful clinical application of PFT, emotional reframing.
Let's talk about therapy. Talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. Millions of people do it. We have decades of empirical data showing that it works for a lot of people.
Right.
But what's wild is that we don't always know why it works on a biological level.
Mm-hmm.
PFT actually attempts to explain biologically, mechanically, why sitting in a room and talking about your feelings changes your reality.
Yes, and it does so by looking at the brain's connectivity. Brizard predicts that if a patient undergoes, say, 6 weeks of successful cognitive reframing therapy, the laboratory won't just see a patient who fills out a questionnaire saying they feel better.
They'll see physical changes.
PFT predicts the lab will see measurable physical changes in the architecture of the brain's networks. Specifically, they will see decreased hyperactivity in the salience network, meaning the brain's conflict monitor stops treating every ambiguous input as a life or death emergency.
That's huge.
And crucially, they will see new strengthened structural connectivity between the MPFC, the interpretive director, and the hippocampus, the memory archives.
So the therapy is literally physically dismantling a maladaptive frame. It breaks down the old F equation where the weight of fear, that W sub A, was too high, and it installs a brand new, healthier interpretive scaffold.
If PFT is correct, it radically redefines how we view psychological suffering. Severe trauma, chronic anxiety, deep-rooted depression, These are not broken brains in the traditional sense of a diseased organ.
What are they then?
They are highly persistent, effectively charged frames that are functioning exactly as the Argmax equation dictates. The brain is doing its math correctly based on the variables it has.
The math is just biased.
The weight of the negative emotion is simply so high that the frame refuses to allow a phase four destabilization. The survival mechanism is working perfectly. It's just stuck in the on position.
That is so incredibly practical and empowering. I want to speak directly to you, the listener, right now. Think about your daily life. When you feel stuck in a rut, when you are trapped in a terrible mood or locked into a rigid, punishing belief system about yourself.
Like, I'm not good enough or everyone is against me.
Exactly. Thoughts like that. You are not stuck in objective reality. You are not seeing the absolute truth of the universe. You are trapped inside a stabilized frame.
You are experiencing the output of an equation where the weights are currently biased against you. The algorithm has locked onto a negative narrative.
Right. And knowing that your reality is just an F of T plus one equation gives you immense tangible agency. It means you have the power to consciously introduce new variables into the math.
You can hack it.
Think about it. If you force yourself to change your environment, go for a walk in nature, change the lighting in your room, you are literally changing the P, the perceptual anchors.
Yes.
If you force yourself to journal about a moment of past success or gratitude, you are actively forcing the hippocampus to change the M, the contextual memory.
And we can take it even further into the physiology. If you take a freezing cold shower or do intense rhythmic deep breathing exercises, you are drastically altering your neurochemistry.
Because of the adrenaline and the shock.
Exactly. You are flushing the system with norepinephrine or changing your vagal tone. You are directly, chemically intervening to change the A, the effective tone.
By intentionally shifting these variables, by throwing a wrench into the equation, you can literally trigger a phase four disruption.
You cause a frame collapse.
You intentionally cause a frame collapse and force your brain's assembly line to build a fresh perspective from scratch. You are not a passive victim of your reality. You are the active architect of its variables.
It completely shifts the paradigm of mental health from a passive state of enduring your thoughts to an active state of engineering them. You are literally learning to hack the mathematical weighting system of your own consciousness.
Okay, let's take a deep breath and recap the massive journey we just took through the architecture of the mind. We started by breaking down the four foundational components of an interpretive frame: perception, memory, affect, and interpretation. The incredibly complex, dynamic, stained glass window through which we view the world.
We then followed those four components through the subsecond neural assembly line, watching how the brain evaluates, selects, and stabilizes a single frame in a matter of milliseconds through a brutal, mathematically weighted neural competition.
We looked at how bleeding-edge science is trying to measure this abstract math in physical reality, using VR labs and fMRI machines, tracking the rigid boundaries of our attention and the active reconstruction of our memories.
We examined the intense friction with academic orthodoxy, the demand for new millisecond decoding tools, the lack of computational simulations, and the philosophical clash between holistic framing and traditional modular reductionism.
And finally, we brought it home to the therapeutic power of reframing. The incredible realization that you can intentionally hack your own reality equation by changing the variables. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought, something to really mull over until our next deep dive.
A look into the technological future of this framework.
Right. We talked about Brizard's specific call for future neural decoding. He wants advanced tools that can read this framing process in real time. Well, what happens in the very near future when brain-computer interfaces BCIs, like the neural implants currently being developed, or highly advanced AI, learn to read those exact mathematical weights in real time?
Oh, wow.
If your conscious reality is dictated by the precise weights of P, M, A, and I, could a device inside your head detect that your mathematical frame is about to lock into a severe depressive state before you even feel sad?
And intervene.
Yeah. And if it detects that, could it artificially inject a targeted microcurrent of electricity into your ACC to force a phase four destabilization?
It is a profound and slightly terrifying ethical and technological horizon. The ability to intervene in the Argmax equation, structurally altering the weights, before the human subject is even consciously aware that the frame is forming.
Are we rapidly approaching an era where we can literally hack the algorithm of our own consciousness from the outside? It brings us right back to where we started today, that video camera metaphor. We wanted reality to be objective, clean, and passive. But instead, we found that the mind is a relentless, active construction site, a stained glass window constantly being forged in the dark of our skulls. And soon, we might not just be looking at the glass, we might be holding the hammer.
An incredible paradigm to navigate as we move forward.
Something to think deeply about the next time you assume you are seeing the world exactly as it is. Until next time.